And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents Thursday edition. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. And today we begin with a look at the importance and prosperity of the South Florida marine industry. It creates a wealth of revenue and jobs in the area. And with us is Michael Joyce. He's the chairman and CEO of Hargrave Custom Yachts of Fort Lauderdale. It dates back to 1957. Welcome to you, Mr. Hargrave.
Nice to be here.
I'm sorry. Mr. Joyce.
No, Mr. Hargrave.
No, Mr. Joyce.
Hargrave is the company.
Oh, okay. Also with us is Steve Moynihan, owner of HMY Yachts. They specialize in yacht sales. Welcome to you.
Thanks so much.
And we also have Frank Atlas. He's the chair and CEO of Atlas Insurance Group. He's quite a colorful character. He's been relating some stories of his media relations and being a producer at CBS.
Yes.
He's also an expert on industry market trends. Welcome to you, Frank Atlas. Good to see you.
Pleasure to be here.
So we were talking before we began just now about how the boating industry has changed dramatically in the last few years. Tell us how.
Oh, it would take longer than the half hour to go through all the
changes. Let's start with a couple of minutes.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the size of the boats have increased immensely, and the numbers of the boats have increased immensely. And, of course, the construction has changed. I mean, everything has changed about it, and it's become a broad, very important part of the economy here in South Florida. And all of us feel lucky that we've been part of this growth and been able to prosper along with it over these many years. However, at this point, we're having a bit of a reconstruction as far as the economy is concerned, and this has affected our business as well.
Michael Joyce, tell us a little bit more about Hargrave Custom Yachts and its history in Fort Lauderdale.
Well, the company, as I mentioned earlier, was originally started in 1957 up in Palm Beach by Jack Hargrave. Jack would be, in the marine industry, he'd be an iconic figure comparable to, say, Frank Lloyd Wright. Jack originally did almost 100% of the design work for Hatteras Yachts, which is a premier brand here. He did work for Berger Yachts, which is another premier brand. And so our original fame came as a design and engineering firm. And then about 10 years ago, the industry shifted so dramatically down to South Florida that we finally decided to move our headquarters down to Fort Lauderdale. And it was a good decision because I think what you need to know or understand is for the yachting industry, Fort Lauderdale and Miami would be the equivalent of Wall Street for finances. Whatever you're trying to find out in the marine industry, it's right here. And that's true for the world. Every major player has a presence here in South Florida.
And Steve Moynihan, more about HMY Yachts.
We're not as old as Joyce and his
group.
Do
you build custom yachts?
No, we're actually a broker-dealer. We sell new boats from five specific manufacturers that we represent. Those boats are built around the world, and we have a significant presence in the yacht brokerage industry. We have 10 offices from between Charleston and Miami, and have 50 sales agents working for us.
But do you also sell used yachts as well?
Yes, that's the brokerage aspect of things.
I see.
Those are pre-owned boats.
What's an average length and cost of today's yacht? Not that I'm interested in buying one.
in our marketplace, we handle vessels that range from 30 feet at 300,000 to 200 feet at 46 million. So, and we cover a lot of geography with those boats.
Michael Joyce, what are some interesting yachts you've built in recent times?
Because we're custom.
And for whom? Can you tell us that?
Yes, if you can tell us.
No, I'd have to kill you. No, I'm sorry.
Okay.
No, I can't. Obviously, in the past, we've built several boats for the chairman of Bacardi here in South Florida, and they have a real passion for water. But if you ask me what's recent, we just had a design meeting where we reviewed a new design that's going into production. It's being built for a woman who's probably 75 years old from New York, has a custom-built 82-footer that we built for now, and you wonder, why would anybody get a different boat? And it was fascinating to watch how the process unfolds. She bought it for three reasons. Number one, it had an on-deck master cabin, so she's planning ahead for mobility issues.
Okay.
she noticed she was turning over crew because she only had a single cabin trying to put two people in that, so she wanted improved crew. And probably the thing that drove it the most is grandchildren. We built this boat, I can't believe it, but we put three big beds in one stateroom, which is totally unusual, totally custom, obviously. Two 42-inch flat screens so the granddaughters can all be playing the video games at the same time. And we've got an entire wall set up to handle all their electronic devices. Now, what people would normally say is, well, if they want to do that, they shouldn't be on the water. But now you got a generation that realizes if you want to be close to your children, and that's what boating's all about, it's strictly about family. If you want to be close to your children, you need to understand where children are today. And as a custom builder, it's very easy for us to make that kind of change on the spot. If you're making hundreds of boats a year, it's complicated. But for a small company that builds maybe six boats a year, we get to respond to that first, and then the industry will look at what we're doing and go, you know, I think they're on the right track with that. So in a small way, we get to be an industry leader, which was one of the things I wanted to do when we started building boats under our own name.
Steve Moynihan, as a broker, I suppose that some of the jet setters and high rollers, when things start to come apart, I guess one of the first things to go would be the yacht. So I suppose that you're able to broker deals to it very advantageously.
In the last 5 years, when we went through this this downturn, no one was immune from the effects of this recession. And by and large, there were very, very aggressive and opportunistic prices available, and we did find ready, willing, and able purchasers from around the world to take advantage of that.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in with a question about perhaps your yacht, that's easy enough, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. And also Bonnie will take your email, that's radio@WLRN.org.
We also have Kathy Rick Jewell. I hope I'm pronouncing your name right. She's the manager of the Miami Boat Show, and she joins us by phone.
It's coming up soon, right?
Yes, it's coming up Thursday, I believe, it begins.
Correct.
Yes. Are you there, Kathy?
I am. Thank you. I lost you there for a second, and you did a good job with my last name. Thank you.
Okay, good. Tell us about the Miami Boat Show and the way it compares to Fort Lauderdale's, for example.
Well, there really isn't any comparison. The two shows, which are, you know, both very well-known events in the state of Florida and actually around the world, have both a very different spin. The 72nd Progressive Insurance Miami International Boat Show that opens its doors a week from today, actually on Valentine's Day, the 14th, is a show that focuses on new boats. We represent new boat marine accessories manufacturers, you know, boat manufacturers and engine manufacturers. And so all of the product in our show is actually new. Relates a little bit different to the Fort Lauderdale show, where the dominance there is a used or brokerage market. So they both exist very peacefully because they have a very different product mix.
What's the economic impact of the Miami Boat Show?
The most current study we did, which was in 2005, is being refreshed at this point on the 2013 show. But we proved just shy of $1 billion in economic impact in the 12 days that the show really encompasses, from the start of the move-in through the show dates to the conclusion.
Mm.
And it was billion with a B.
That's billion. Yes.
That's right. Yeah, it was $817 million. So we expect certainly, many years later now, what will be 7 years later, we'll continue to see those numbers increase.
Frank Atlas, Atlas Insurance Company. Is Broward County the biggest marine county of our area? And what about Dade, Monroe, and Palm Beach? Where do they fit in?
Well, we have the counties all along the coast here in Florida. There's more boats in Florida, with the exception of the state of Michigan, as far as total count is concerned. But
there's a lot of water there, too.
But yeah, indeed. But the value of the boats down here far exceed Michigan's boats, because they're much smaller. And not only do we have a lot of boats that live here, we have huge amounts of boats that travel here. And some of the biggest boats in the world are in here. And Matt, I just came out this morning. I saw who's the producer of Lincoln? Steven Spielberg, his boat was sitting right in the harbor as we came in. It's a big 300-footer, immense boat. We're talking a $150 million vessel. Sitting right in Fort Lauderdale today.
Did you get me an invite to go aboard?
I wish I could. But no. This is typical of what happens here because we do have a great amount of vessels that are travel across to the Caribbean and then back down to over to Europe and then back to the Caribbean every year and visit Florida. So it isn't just the industry that we have here from what we create. There's also a tremendous amount of visitors here.
Michael, you wanted to add something?
You were talking about economic impact, and one of the things you don't often get to compliment the legislature on anything, but they made a really gutsy call about 3 years ago. They put a cap on taxes, and they capped it at $18,000, which immediately was perceived as they're doing this for rich people. And the reality is rich people don't need a boat, as we all know. And when the taxes are unfavorable, these boats are global and they move. So when they suddenly put that in, the first year, it stalled because that was just as the industry was going into the recession. But shortly after that, all the numbers began to shoot up. The total revenue to the state, the taxes collected by all the suppliers. And what happened is these boats, like he's talking about, Steven Spielberg, that boat's in town here probably 5-6 months a year. And those boats will spend $5-10 million a year just coming off the side of the boat. So for South Florida, to their credit, they really made a wise decision. And now these boats that used to be disappear in the summertime, you'll see these mega, mega yachts coming into
South Florida. What size of a crew would a boat like that have? And are they on board wherever it is?
They're on board 24 hours a day. They would have a small boat would have 10 people. And a big boat could have 20 to 30 people.
Or 40 or 50 or 60.
We have a emailer about jobs created by the marine industry, which we'll get to as soon as we take a short break. It is Topical Currents. We're speaking about South Florida marine industry with Michael Joyce, Steve Moynihan, Frank Atlas, and Kathy Rick-Jewell. Stay with us, and we'll be right back.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you, 21 minutes past 1 o'clock. Also with Bonnie Berman, and we're talking about the South Florida marine industry. We're kind of focusing on yachts. Tell me, Steve Moynihan, for we in the hoi polloi, what kind of fuel is involved here? It's diesel, and what would it cost to fill up one of these boats?
Well, it depends on the size of the boat, but you can multiply the fuel capacity times anywhere between $4 and $4.50 a gallon right now for diesel fuel, you'll get your answer.
So it could be like $500,000 then.
The large boats, yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Kathy Jewell, also tell us more about the Miami International Boat Show. I suppose there's a website involved where people can learn more about.
Oh, absolutely. Well, the details of the show, as you suggest, are, you know, widely publicized on our website at MiamiBoatShow.com. We will have just about 2,500 boats on display between three locations and over 1,000 booths devoted to every type of marine accessory you can imagine, from, you know, safety equipment to, all sorts of nautical jewelry to monogram towels to life jackets to all the types of things that boaters are always looking for. So there's a huge variety of product, like I said, spread between three different locations.
Let's start with one.
Okay. We have an emailer, Jason. He would like our guests to give estimates on the number of jobs created in Florida by the yachting industry and to find out if the jobs are good-paying or low-wage jobs. And whoever
I imagine there's a lot of craftsmen involved.
Yeah.
Well, if you're just looking for a number, the Marine Industries Association of South Florida estimates there's 110,000 jobs in the marine industry just here in South Florida. And what I would tell somebody who's looking at it as a career, if it's strictly the money, this is not the place to look. I mean, there's so many other jobs that are heavily unionized where maybe the pay scale's higher. What you'll find is everybody in this business is here by choice. And once they get into the marine industry, wherever they are, they tend to stay for the rest of their career. So I think you'll find it's rewarding work. It changes every single day. Whatever you did yesterday, you're doing something different today. So it's you'll find whether you're talking about working in a boatyard or working in a sales organization or working in manufacturing, they're all different, and it's a great way to go through life.
And let's take a call or two. This is Victor. He's in Coral Gables. And I accidentally lost Miss Jules. She'd like to call in. We can do that.
Oh, okay. Kathy, we lost you, so if you want to call back.
My error, as usual. Victor, go ahead.
I'm here. Thank you. Thank you, Joe. Gentlemen are talking about mega yachts and boats of that nature, the Spielberg boat and the of that ilk. And yes, you go up to Fort Lauderdale, and I remember years ago you would see smaller boats, sailboats, a lot of sailboats, you know, in the 30, 40, 50-foot range. You're hard-pressed to see that now. My question is, how do they, I mean, they're painting a very bright future for South Florida based around people with a lot of means coming from South America and the Caribbean and all over, bringing their boats here for fitting out, et cetera. But how do they envision what's happening, what's going to happen to the small boat owner, someone who owns a 26-foot little power boat or someone that owns a 40-foot sailboat? Due to the fact of development in the Dinnakee area, especially, and in Coconut Grove, the anchorages are fewer and fewer, and the cost of goods is more and more. And in fact, when you pull into a dock in Fort Lauderdale to get gas and you're only putting on 20 gallons, they look at you like you're crazy. I understand all that. But how do they envision the future for the small boat owner? I'll bring it on to you, and I'll stand by. Thank
okay.
you.
Frank Atlas, or who?
Well, the small boat owner is the beginning of our whole industry. This is, everyone starts small and gets bigger. And I think if you were to go out and take a look in Biscayne Bay any weekend, you'd see a plethora of small boats, both power and sail. And it's still one of the great sailing competition areas in America.
Having said that, I agree, you see. But if you compare what you see today, whether it's the Columbus Day Regatta, what is it, a Coconut Grove Sailing Club, the memberships are down, the boats, there's I've been boating in this area for 40 years. There's a, I would say, a 20th or a 50th of the amount of boats that are out there today. And they're being squeezed out. I'm not saying it's your guys' fault, but I was just wondering what you see as the future. Let's not say that the boating industry for small boats, let's not give that impression, is blossoming in here. Every yacht club, every marina, whether it's Biscayne Bay Yacht Club, Coral Reef Yacht Club, or Miami Yacht Club, Coconut Grove Sailing Club, they're all suffering, and they're suffering because fewer and fewer people are able to afford the boats.
Victor Michael Joyce would like to chime in here.
Thank you.
Everything you say has a valid basis behind it, Victor. Obviously, you know, as an industry, you don't come on to tell what the problems are. I mean, I belong to a yacht club. I belong to several of them, so I understand the economics of it. And a lot of what you're talking about is driven by the state of the economy. I can tell you one thing. You mentioned the Coral Reef Yacht Club. I can tell you this, in 10 years, you'll have to know somebody even to figure out how to get on their waiting list. So a lot of what we're living through now is economics. And when you're talking about South Florida, it's driven by natural economic forces. We are at the bottom of the funnel in the United States. You take anybody with money anywhere in this country and drop them in the funnel, they come out right here. So that force of money begins to drive out the smaller boat, not through any grand scheme, but when you have that influx of money. Now, you go north, you go to Palm Beach, or you go north of that to Stewart, the boats get smaller in a real hurry. So if you live in Key Biscayne, it's a real problem. I understand what you're saying. I own small boats. I don't own big boats. So I agree with you, but you can't stop economics.
So the smaller boater is the one affected by development and less coastal docking and marine areas.
The city,
the price goes up because of the lack of...
The city and developer, the look at the land they got. We got 300 little boats, and they're between 20 and 30 feet, and then somebody shows up with an economic forecast and says, you know, if we rip all these out and put in 150-footers, you know, so... What he's saying is that's just the force of the economy.
Or condos.
The same thing has happened to the houses. I mean, we had little houses. Now they have houses that go out to the lot line and up four stories and cost millions of dollars. It's economics, absolutely.
And we actually have customers in the Coral Reef Yacht Club who started out in 33 footers since we've been in business, and they moved to 45 and went to 54, and now they're in 70. So that is also a trend that you see. People do get larger and larger boats. At some point, that situation will change because they'll get out of boating, they'll retire from boating, they'll die, and then the next group comes in.
What's that old saying? Is the two happiest days of my life are when I bought my boat and when I sold it?
No. Oh, you heard that, huh?
Mike, excuse me, Evan wants to know if Hargrave actually builds yachts in South Florida.
Right now, we're not. We built here in the U.S., South Florida. If you look at most of the manufacturing for boats, most of it has left South Florida.
Why is that?
Because the land's more valuable for other purposes. If you look at companies like Bertram, they've moved to northern Florida. If you look at all the smaller manufacturers, most of them have moved up to central. So they go where they can get labor at a price where they can deliver the boat at a retail. So in South Florida, it's not that I wouldn't like to, but I don't believe there's any yacht manufacturer building here at the moment. Doesn't mean they won't as the economics change.
So are there good incentives for marine businesses to relocate to South Florida, or is it?
Oh, absolutely. The state recognizes we're probably the second biggest employer in the state. So when you go to them with a business proposal, they're there. I mean, I much as I knock them sometimes, they've been very supportive of the
marine
industry.
Let's hear the knock. No, what's the main complaint?
Well, you think,
complaint?
Oh, the government's trying to make everything harder, and they're just always in the way. And the reality is when you come in with an actual issue and tell them what it is, it's surprising how quickly they can respond. I mean, here in South Florida, we were heavily penalized by something called the Longshoremen's Act. It held us to a standard and required an expenditure that tied into unloading ships. And when they finally took that to Congress in the U.S. and said, what can we do? They said, you're right. It doesn't belong on pleasure boats. We'll take it off. So they understand jobs.
Let's take one more email.
One more email. Wesley says he lives in Palm Beach, had a question about custom sport fishers. He owns a custom 58-foot Lydia.
Sure. Built in Stewart.
And wondered if you make custom sport boats, and could you tell me about some you've made in the past?
At Hargrave, sure. We built custom sport fish both in the U.S. We built them in England. We built them in South America. So most of what we built in the past was in the 50 to 60 foot size range. Now what's happened is custom building keeps going up and up. So everything we build right now is probably 5 million and up.
Well, we certainly want to thank you. We've been visiting with Michael Joyce, Chairman and CEO of Hargrave Custom Yachts of Fort Lauderdale. Also with us was Steve Moynihan, owner of HMY Yachts. And also we had Frank Atlas, Chair and CEO of Atlas Insurance Group. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Hey, thanks for having us. We enjoyed it.
Thanks
for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Food and Dining up next. And it is today's Topical Currents, Thursday edition. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Food and Dining has finally arrived. I'm with chef, author, and syndicated columnist Linda Gastenheimer. She'll be taking the helm of the program. Our longtime friend and colleague, wine columnist and reporter Fred Tasker is back in the studio. And we have Linda, a Food Network celebrity and famous restaurateur, with us.
We sure do. So Joe and Bonnie, Chopped. Kind of sounds ominous, don't you think? Well, actually, it's a TV show and one of the Food Network's most popular shows. It's chefs who are pitted against chefs for another reality food show. And our guest is Scott Conant, and he's a judge on Chopped. He also wears many other hats. He's the owner of Scarpetta Restaurants, one of them at the Fontainebleau in Miami Beach. And he's a cookbook author. His latest book is Bold Italian. Welcome, Scott Conant. Are you with us?
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for having me.
Great to have you with us. And we'd also have our listeners to be with us. Do you have any questions for our guest? Give us a call. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN.
And email, that's radio@WLRN.org.
And as Joe mentioned, we've got Fred in the studio.
Indeed.
Instead of by Skype today.
In the flesh.
Yes.
He's looking well, too.
Right. And you can read Fred's...
It's all that snow.
That's right.
he says hale and hearty.
He says he loves the snow. But you can read Fred's wine column in today's Miami Herald. And Fred, what's in your glass today?
Well, I thought I'd talk about some of the Italian wines of the snow-covered Alps.
Well,
just
so
I don't have to be without my snow.
Okay. Let's go to Scott Conan. Scott, Chopped. How does the contest work, and where did the name Chopped come from?
Well, the way it works is there's four chefs that are competing against one another, and each chef gets a basket of ingredients. It's a really some really kind of far-out fun ingredients as well. Fun to cook with, maybe not so much fun to eat sometimes. They'll have anything from a sirloin steak to gummy worms. You just don't know what they're going to get.
Gummy worms?
The candy.
Yeah.
Oh.
The candy.
not in the same dish, I hope.
Yeah.
Oh,
no, really in the same dish. They'll have four ingredients. And, you know, it'll stem from, you know, some kind of fruit, a vegetable, sometimes a piece of candy, a protein. And the key is that it's kind of like a puzzle. I mean, each one of these baskets has some kind of flavor combination that could work. But we don't, as judges, these baskets until the day of.
Scott, we kind of have a crummy telephone connection with you. Could you maybe move around wherever you are? I know you're on cell.
Yes. I'm sorry.
There
you go. What was that? That's much better, Scott.
Is that okay?
That's
perfect.
Much better.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So, yeah, we as judges don't see any of these ingredients beforehand. But there'll be mornings where, you know, we start shooting very early. And at 8 a.m., we'll have a plate of duck testicles in front of us that we just don't know.
duck? Did they have them?
Gee, I had that for breakfast.
Far from delicious sometimes.
So this goes on all day. So by the time we've seen the show, it's all been cut. It's not all in real time.
Yeah, it's about a 12-hour shoot for us. But the show is about an hour long, so it's cut down to about 44, 46 minutes.
But so why Chopped? Where does that name come from?
Well, so Chopped means as each of the chefs compete in each round, one of them will be chopped from moving forward. And the judges' table is the chopping block. Yeah.
Okay, so it could have been called Axed. Is that what it is?
Could have been called a bunch of things,
so
not
is it,
delicious more often than not.
But is it true? I mean, what we see, is it real? I mean, are those chefs actually doing that kind of cooking and coming up with those dishes for you?
Oh, they actually are. In the appetizer round, they have 20 minutes. In the main course and dessert rounds, they have 30 minutes. And, you know, I made a promise to myself a very long time ago that, I'm a chef. I have restaurants, and a real chef, not a TV chef. So I made a promise to myself that if I were going to do any television, it was going to be real and it was going to have integrity. And that was the key for me. So this show does.
For most people, cooking is a relaxing sideline. Why is it so popular to have this hyperventilated, intense competition? Why is that so popular?
You know what? If I could answer that question, I'd be making a lot more money than I currently am.
I think the general public wants to see suffering.
Maybe you're right.
Go ahead.
Scott, we have an emailer for you. I'm a big fan of Chopped, and I'm wondering why Scott isn't fond of raw red onions. Also, what is the worst dish batch of ingredients he's ever eaten on the show?
This raw red onions has been all over the internet. Scott, what's this all about?
They give me a lot of grief for the onions. You know,
from Melissa.
Alyssa, let me explain this. We're talking about cooking and developing flavors in haute cuisine. We're not talking about going to a deli and throwing some ingredients together. So I have, it's a little tough love that I give sometimes on this show, and I really want these chefs to excel. And also, I think it's a great opportunity for them to learn something and maybe be a little bit more thoughtful than they would otherwise be. And hopefully they can walk away with that in mind, just being a little bit more thoughtful for the ingredients. And, a big pile of raw red onions on a plate is not, for me, it's not developing or nuancing flavors. For me, it's overpowering flavors. And unless that raw red onion is an actual ingredient in the dish, I think you're overpowering the other ingredients on the plate.
She also wants to know, what's the worst dish batch of ingredients you've ever eaten on the show?
Well, anything with durian.
Oh, you have to explain what durian is. I'm laughing. I know what it is, but go ahead. Explain what it is.
Durian is an Asian melon, and it is very pungent. It's extremely, extremely, I mean, it's, for lack of a better word, it just really stinks. It's extremely offensive, I find. I love, you know, ripe cheeses and deep flavors and all that kind of stuff. But I find durian really, you know, it's on my list of three ingredients that I just will not eat. I just find it wildly offensive.
Well, actually, you're right. I mean, durian, if it's in the room and they open it up, you just want to run the other way.
Where's it from?
Southeast Asia.
Southeast Asian.
I was in Bangkok one time, and the restaurants would ban it from their premises because it just stunk up the whole place.
But some people love it.
Well, the
really
flavor is
it.
Great. It's the aroma that's awful. The flavor, if you hold your nose, the flavor is good.
Well, I don't think Scott
which
thinks
you,
so.
I'm sure is what you want to do with your food.
I'm going to disagree with you on that one.
Let's go on to some other flavors, all right? Let's talk about bold Italian flavors. Now, you own Scarpetta Restaurant here at the Fontainebleau Hotel in Miami Beach, and you have several other Italian restaurants, Italian-style restaurants.
One in Toronto, right?
Yes, and are you opening one in Los
Vegas.
Angeles now?
I'm in Los Angeles right now. I have one in Beverly Hills. I have a Scarpetta in Las Vegas at the Cosmopolitan Hotel. And one in New York City. It's an independent restaurant on 14th and 9th.
Okay, so bold Italian flavors. What did you mean by that? What are the bold flavors?
Well, when I was writing this book, the one thing that I really wanted people to appreciate and maybe experience were deep, assertive flavors. So not one-dimensional flavors, but rather flavors that would really come together well and be very harmonious. And, you know, I think from a marketing perspective, the people who had the publisher really felt that bold Italian cooking was something that would stand out as a title. And I was perfectly, my first book was called New Italian Cooking, so you can only use that once. So bold Italian, it may resonate as far as the flavors go, but there really are a lot of nuances inside those flavors as well as being very assertive and bold.
So what should we have in our kitchen if we're going to be doing some bold flavored Italian cooking? What are some of the essentials?
Well, you know, I'm a big believer in understanding the history of Italian food and really understanding what makes it great in the first place. So, you know, a little bit of garlic, extra virgin olive oil, and crushed red pepper are pretty much staples for a lot of the dishes that I make, and I think that's really important. I think few people who really love pasta would argue that a spaghetti aglio olio, spaghetti with garlic, olive oil, peperoncino, crushed red pepper, is one of the best pastas ever if it's done properly.
Well, you know, I'm glad to hear that because so often we get Italian food and it's just drowned in tomato sauce and pasta sauce and we don't get any other flavor.
Yeah, I agree with you. I try to stay away from those kind of restaurants, and I definitely don't cook that kind of food. I grew up in a very traditional kitchen environment, like very French food. I went to CIA, I traveled through Europe, I worked in Germany and Italy and things like that. And what I've learned over the years is that, you know, it's really the simplicity and the perfect execution of those dishes that's going to be what people walk away with and the most memorable.
And have really wonderful flavors. Well, I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and my guest today is food TV celebrity Scott Conant. We're going to take a short break here, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we're talking with Food Network celebrity Scott Conant. He's a judge on the reality chef contest Chopped, and he's also owner of the Scarpetta Restaurant at the Fontainebleau Hotel here in Miami Beach, and he also has several other restaurants throughout the states and also Toronto.
I believe so.
Yes. And his latest book is Bold Italian, And he's been giving us some tips on cooking great Italian food at home and telling us about behind the scenes at Chopped. But now, if you're going to be cooking at home, we have a dinner in minutes for you. And it's an Italian one today. So, Joe and Bonnie, you've been eating it.
Yes, ma'am.
And Fred, you got your lunch today.
I finally got a lunch. I'm so happy.
Well, you have to join us more often. It's a Northern Italian chicken gorgonzola with fresh linguine and sweet pimentos. Now, the Lombardy region of Northern Italy is known for its dairy products. And for this reason, this recipe, it coats, I have the gorgonzola sauce. It's coating the chicken, the boneless, skinless chicken breasts. So you just dredge those that chicken in flour and brown it in the skillet, and then take them out, and I put a little milk in the skillet, picking up the brown bits, and some gorgonzola cheese, and let that go to a nice smooth sauce.
And you can make dinner in minutes in 15 minutes? It sounds like you could do that.
All you're doing is you're just putting the chicken in the pot and the thing, cooking it for a couple of minutes per side. Take it out.
Yeah, they cook fast, the breasts.
Then you put the milk in with a little cheese and put the chicken back in. Get a nice tangy, just taste that tangy kind of gorgonzola sauce. And you could use any kind of blue cheese for the recipe at dinner in minutes. And then the side dish is very simple. You just buy some fresh linguine, cook it up, and toss it with some olive oil and some sweet pimento cut into strips. Well, that whole dish is at Dinner in Minutes with a photo, dinnerinminutes.com. And by the way, all of my recipes fit the government nutritional guidelines. And please follow me on Twitter at L. Gassenheimer. So how was it? Did you like it, Joe?
Yes, indeed. Piping hot, too.
Too much.
Very nice. Very
too
nice.
Much tangy for you, huh? Okay. I don't know, Joe. Fred, what are we drinking?
Well, you know, the great thing about Italian cuisine to me is that it varies so much from region to region. And the great thing about Italian wines is that they also vary greatly by region. And since the wines of a region have grown up for centuries with the cuisine of those regions, they tend to go very well together. The white wines of northeast Italy with the seafood of the Adriatic Sea, and the red wines of Tuscany with its cuisine, which goes from wild boar to the famous Florentine steak. And I was at an Italian tasting just a couple of days ago at Miami-Dade College's new Culinary Institute, which, by the way, is very fancy, and that demonstrated this. They had Master of Wine Laura Di Pasquale, who presented what she called the iconic whites of Italy. And two of them from northern Italy were particularly good with the seafood of the Venice region on the Adriatic Sea. One was something I'd never tried before, a sparkling Pinot Grigio. Linda, did you ever have a sparkling Pinot Grigio?
No. How do they sparkle it?
The same way they sparkle champagne. They just let it do a secondary fermentation in the bottle that creates carbon dioxide, and they trap it, and there it is. And it was very nice.
How was it?
It was light and lean and very zingy because of the bubbles, and it had kind of a grapefruit flavor. And it was a great wine for shellfish. And then another wine, which I had never had before, was a white from a grape called Ribolla Gialla, which is quite rare. And it's from the winery Conte d'Atimas in Friuli, which is way up north of Venice.
So this is a grape that only grows in that area?
Basically, in that area. That's kind of the home of it, and that's up in the Alpine foothills.
It must be cold for grapes.
It is. It was fresh and lively, and it was actually more floral than fruity, but it would go really well with the shrimp scampi from the cafes of Venice or something like that. Then came the real wine, the Italian reds, which were presented by a well-known South Florida sommelier, Charlie Arturola. I can never pronounce
Arturola,
that.
Arturola, yeah.
Arturola. He presented a wonderful Brunello di Montalcino from Tuscany. And this is a big, full-bodied, hearty wine from the Sangiovese grape. You might call it a Chianti on steroids.
It's really a good one, too.
Oh, yeah, it is. It is very nice. And it's powerful and rich and the perfect complement for Tuscany's most famous, this is for you, Joe, a big red steak, the Bistecca Fiorentina, which is a steak that is grilled with olive oil and garlic and rosemary.
So I'm the chief garlic boar here.
Yeah, exactly. But they usually give it to you in a full kilo portion. That's 2.2 pounds. So you need to come hungry.
Joe. And he's complaining about my chicken with the gorgonzola sauce.
Yeah. Finally, Charlie presented a powerful red Barolo from Tenuta Careta, and it's made from the inky black powerful Nebbiolo grape in Piemonte, which is the foothills of the Alps, so it's in really cold territory. And it goes really well with the wild game that they hunt in the mountains. So each region has its own food and has its own wine. And the whole thing had me ready to move to Italy and buy an estate, except I'm a few million dollars short.
Scott Conan, what kind of Italian wines do you serve at your Scarpetta's?
We have a varied list in every restaurant, because it's really important, like you said, to really match the food with the wine. We have a lot of people have come into the restaurant who have those estates in Italy, so we have a wide variety, and we also have people who want to experience those estates through the bottles of wine. So it's a lot of work that each sommelier in each store. I have a master sommelier actually in Las Vegas working for us, and he is just amazing. The amount of knowledge that he has, it's really exciting.
Sounds like a fun job.
Fred would like to join in there, I think. So, Scott, do you find that in your various restaurants, different regions of the United States, people ask for different types of food?
You know, fortunately, when people make their way into Scarpetta, they may have heard of us, or they may know what they're kind of getting into. So we don't necessarily... I like to tap into the region of the where we are in each restaurant and really tap into the soul of that space, use local ingredients, use a lot of organic ingredients as well.
Does Las Vegas have a soul?
It's in there somewhere. You know, you'd be surprised. I don't know how much time you spent in Las Vegas, and I, for better or worse, I've spent a lot of time there with these restaurants. But, you know, it's a wonderful community, and when you meet people who are locals there, they really do have a great sense of that local space that they're really proud of, and they're trying to grow the downtown area. They're doing a lot of things in the community. I was involved with the Community Through Schools, which is a charity organization which keeps kids in school in Nevada in general. And it's really an interesting place, and the people, the natives, the locals are really wonderful.
Well, that sounds wonderful. And now you're going to be coming to Miami soon for the South Beach Food and Wine Festival. It's in about 2 weeks from now. That's February 21st through the 24th. So what will you be doing? We only have about 30 seconds left, but what will you be doing there at the festival?
Well, I'll be at the best of the best where at the Fountain Blue, where a bunch of great chefs and great wineries are all lined up and cooking some great, delicious food. We have a great porchetta that we're doing and pairing with wines throughout. It's just a great fun.
I was going to ask you what, so Scarpetta is going to be, for people who don't know, the best of the best is where lots of chefs from all over the United States come, and they are serving up their foods.
And some really good wines.
And some, Fred always tells me about the wines there. Well, it's been a really tasty week here. It's Scott Conan. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Okay, he'll be at the South Beach Food and Wine Festival's Best of the Best. Fred, it's great to have you back in the studio with us.
Nice to be here.
All right. And Joseph and Bonnie? You ate well today.
Thank you very much for lunch, Linda, as usual.
Okay.
And great to see you, Fred.
Nice to see you, Bonnie.
He's here, and the worst snowstorms are coming up there, so good to have you.
I'm missing out, yeah.
Maybe he won't be able to get back.
Could be.
All right. Well, next week we'll be talking with megastar Martha Stewart and celebrating Valentine's Day with some Moët Hennessy's cognac. How's that sound, Fred?
I'm ready.
We're going to have Martha Stewart on.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, they're all of these people are coming in for the festival,
right.
So it's going to be a
Joe. That means you and I have to be correct.
I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And that wraps up today's edition. Our producer is Richard Ive. Technical direction from Caroline Brader Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Free audio archives and downloads at our website, that's WLRN.org. And you can follow us at the Topical Currents Facebook page for author and book links, discussions, and more. Today's recipe at dinnerinminutes.com. Tomorrow at 1, it's Ed Bell and the South Florida Arts Beat. Monday, we return for a program with journalist Sam Pizzagatti and his book, The Rich Don't Always Win. He chronicles 20th century triumphs over the American plutocracy. And the calendar. On this day in 1812, 201 years ago, the birth of Charles Dickens in Portsmouth, England. None of his timeless novels have ever gone out of print. And on this day in 1885, 128 years ago, the birth of novelist and social critic Sinclair Lewis in Minnesota. He was the first American to win the Nobel Prize for Literature. That was in 1930. Main Street, Babbitt, Aerosmith, Elmer Gantry. One more while we muse on the glory days of old Miami Beach. On this day, 1926, 87 years ago, the famous Roney Plaza Hotel opens. It was the first Miami Beach hotel to have cabanas, tennis, a nine-hole golf course, and the famous Bamboo Room and restaurant. I'm told Fred Tasker used to hang there. Roney Plaza was sold in 1968 and raised to build the Roney Plaza Apartments. That's a 23rd and Collins. We leave with a thought from Sinclair Lewis, who refused a Pulitzer Prize in 1925, quote, "When fascism comes to America, it will be wrapped in the flag and carrying a cross." Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman, Fred, and Linda. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.